Hello and welcome to the TCR number 8 daily podcast, supported by our race partners Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets and Pedaled. I'm Tom Probert and every day for the next 2 weeks I'll be chatting to fellow TCR veterans Karen Tosti and Rob Quirk. We'll be recapping each day's race action, talking about stories coming from the riders' social media and answering your questions about what it's like to ride the transcontinental race. So let's meet our panel. First up, Karen, welcome to the pod. Are you excited for the return of the TCR?
Hello. Yeah, I'm very excited for the return of the TCR. It feels like it's been a long time coming. So I can't even imagine what it feels like for the riders getting to the start line. It's probably been an even longer time coming for them.
Absolutely. And you've ridden the transcontinental race before, haven't you? Which one did you do?
Yeah, so I rode TCR number 5 in 2017. So we were riding from Gerardsbergen through to Meteora in Greece. I've had a few years off doing anything quite so epic. So I'm happy to be in the spectating seat this year.
Yeah, quite a different experience, isn't it? And whereabouts are you based when you're dot watching HQ?
I am in York in my little home office, moonlighting on this podcast whilst holding down my unrelated to cycling day job.
Lovely stuff. All right. And we're also joining us, another TCR vet, Rob. Welcome to the pod.
Hello.
How are you doing? How are you feeling about the TCR?
Yeah, very excited for this one. It's nice to see it return. I think for a lot of people, the Transcontinental is seen as one of the more, central to everyone's hearts, because it's one of the originals, especially in Europe, and it's what kickstarted it for everyone else. So it's great to see it return. Definitely looking forward to following some of those dots.
Yeah, you can really sense that kind of anticipation building when you kind of go on social media and stuff. It does feel a little bit different and a little bit bigger than kind of the other races that have been happening already this summer. So yeah, it's definitely building. And you actually are quite central to the scene yourself, because you actually build bikes for this specific type of ultra distance riding, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. For those who don't know, I'm a frame builder, so I do Quirk cycles. And when I started back in 2015, I did set out to try and find a way of testing the models that I was making. And I couldn't think of a better way of doing it than pulling the machine as well as myself through these trials, through these ultra races, and to see, I thought it'd be a really good way of testing the metal of the bike as well as definitely myself. So I was lucky enough to, I took part in 2016 in TCR number 4. And it's really nice to see that this year, one of the checkpoints is again in Dermator National Park in Montenegro, which was a really significant turning point for me when I did the race in TCR number 4.
Lovely stuff. Well, it'd be good to get your thoughts on that as we go through Dermator, then. I'm sure that'll start bringing back some memories whenever that's going to happen, when the first riders start going through there. Well, look, guys, I'm looking forward to spending the next couple of weeks hanging out with you on a very regular basis, and probably from increasingly strange hotels as the race heads east across Europe. So we'll do a little review of the weird hotel rooms that I find myself in as well. We're also going to be hearing from Becky Waters of DotWatcher.cc fame, who will be stepping in for a couple of guest appearances along the way, maybe more depending on how often we start dropping out as the pace kind of ramps up. The start of the TCR is rapidly approaching now, and we've got roughly 280 cyclists from all across the world descending on Gerritsbergen in Belgium, ready for the start of the race. And, you know, for these guys, this is like the culmination of months, if not years, of like dedication and sacrifice as well. And like now it's finally happening, which can feel quite surreal, can't it, when it actually comes around. You guys have both been there, and well, so have I. And, you know, it'd just be good to get an idea of like what is going through riders' heads as that start line kind of gets closer and closer.
It's a very weird feeling arriving in Gerritsbergen. And so I arrived the day beforehand. I met a friend who was living in the Netherlands who I hadn't seen for years, and this seemed like a great opportunity for us to catch up. So she joined me for this very weird pre-race period. So we met at Brussels station, and we rode out to Gerritsbergen. And arriving the day before, I was staying in a little hostel, and I remember the town just feeling really quiet, and I was like, oh my gosh, have I had a major route planning error before I've even started the race? Am I in just entirely the wrong town? It was very quiet. There weren't many people around. But then the next day, it was like the floodgates had opened. There were just lycra clad people with all types of different bikes and different levels of kit on their bikes, kind of suddenly descending on the town. But yeah, this kind of strange lull where you're waiting for the start. You've got to go to sign on, but there's quite a lot of time to kill and not much to do with it, other than, depending on your personality, chill out and sleep and eat food and relax and enjoy the atmosphere, or worry about you've got the wrong kit, everyone else looks more prepared, you know, faff with your mechanics and probably make something worse on your bike. Different schools, different ways of dealing with it. But yeah, I found it was a very kind of strange, just quite a strange moment, suspended in time, just waiting for the inevitable.
Which one of those schools of thought did you fall into?
I think I was a bit of both, flipping and flopping, actually. I remember I definitely tried to make myself just eat food and have a nap on the pavement somewhere in the shade. But I don't think I was very successful, because I think my natural personality would be defaulting more towards the kind of endless list of what I should be preparing for. Just eyeing up everyone else's kit, thinking that they've brought something that you should have brought. You haven't got something that you should have brought, etc. There's also the bike check, isn't there? Someone checking your bike for safety, which is great, but I was just worrying that my bike was going to fail the safety check and I wouldn't be able to ride. All sorts of ridiculous anxiety. Maybe it feels a bit like a pre-exam sensations.
What are your memories of that, Rob? Were you like the chilled out person asleep under a table, or were you kind of like worrying about your stuff that you might have forgotten to set up properly?
That's a good question, and I'm really trying to remember. And partly it's similar to Karen, you know, it's an odd experience, and I was just trying to think about why is that so odd. And when it comes back to it, it's like you. I think it was on Christmas Eve is when I got the email saying that I'd got a place in the race. So then all of a sudden you're like, oh my god, Now I know. Now I've got to, start training. So then you go on this 6-month journey of planning your diet, cutting things like it's different for everyone. I stopped drinking. I start doing all this, and 6 months of every day you're just thinking about this race. You're preparing. You're getting your bike ready. You're getting your body ready, and then you jump on the train like the same day, because it like starts at 10 o'clock at night, which I think is unique in ultra races. I'm not sure of any other races that start at in the nighttime. I think a lot of them start during the morning, if I'm right. Correct me if I'm wrong. But so you can arrive on the same day that the race starts. So you'll get the Eurostar and then you see loads of riders on the Eurostar and you're like, oh yeah, you're going to do the TCR. And you arrive and then you kind of just float around Gerolsbergen waiting for this race to start. And so you end up in this weird limbo after having done nothing but think about this moment for half a year. And then you learn, you're just like, oh, now I just wait. And yeah, it's a crazy mix of nerves, excitement, and almost boredom, because you just want it. Mm-hmm. You just want it to happen. You just want it to start. So yeah, you eat. You maybe try and do, like, you know, I remember going in the town hall, trying to be like a tourist. Ooh, Gerolsbergen. But it's difficult to do much. And of course, you meet other riders. So you just start making friends, basically. I mean, for myself, it was the first ultra I did. So really, I didn't have anything to compare it to or a sort of experience I've had before that I, on this scale, you know, on the scale of a race that can take you 2 weeks, which took me 2 weeks, you know, it was difficult to know how to compute all of those emotions and make sense of them.
Yeah, but I mean, at least there are some kind of practical things that you can focus on, aren't there, which I found kind of helps. You know, there's still some like quite straightforward stuff to do. Like you say, eating is one of them, because that's something that, you know, especially because it's such a late start, that's kind of, it is weird, isn't it? It kind of throws your rhythm, because you know you're going to have to fuel yourself to be riding throughout this night when you wouldn't ever normally be riding, so you're not really used to knowing when to eat for that. And I remember there's one pasta place, isn't there? I don't know if you remember that. That's kind of seems to be the like mecca. Yeah. It's just got about 100 cyclists sat outside it with pots of pasta, and they're just churning them out. Did you guys go there?
Yeah,
I did go there. Remember being, I think I was pretty disappointed with the size of the portion, so I think I went back for a second innings, but. Yeah,
nice.
I feel like certainly at least for one night a year, they're the hottest ticket in town.
Absolutely. And did you guys think about going for a ride?
Don't think I did anything substantial. I see Rob shaking his head as well. I think
very, you know, sensible.
I made friends with some people at the sign-on, and we went for a little spin, maybe to like the supermarket. And I remember someone had a mechanical on that expedition, so we'd already lost one to go and find a bike shop. So I guess it's probably a good idea to go for a little spin, work out if you've got a problem before you're halfway up the Muir and your derailleur's pinging off or something.
Yeah.
Because I guess a lot of people, some people have had to fly there, so they've maybe put their bikes together. Might be some, yeah. You're not always arriving with the bike in the perfect state that it was that you're used to be riding, you know, for all your training, because you might have had to take it apart a bit to put it in a box to get on a plane or to get on a train or whatever. So I do remember there being quite a few little issues occurring on that first day.
Yeah, I think I left all the kind of bike testing to the first day of the actual race, when you start realizing things that you haven't set up properly.
I had a really good experience where right literally as the sort of like doing the countdown to start, the guy next to me, his dynamo just stopped working. So then I was like, oh well, I give you a hand. Then they got his dynamo working. It was before the race, so it was like, yeah, no assist and stuff. But so yeah, I was kind of like fixing other people's bikes and not my own. My problems came much further down the line, but
I remember on the first lap, you do one lap of the town, don't you, and then you go up the moor. And I remember on that first lap, my kind of third bottle fell out of its holder, which, you know, I'd probably put that on as a special TCR thing that I hadn't really ridden with before. And it was probably fine on smooth roads, but parts of that lap are like on cobbles, aren't they? And I hit the cobbles and the bottle just went flying. So I found myself stopped by the side of the road trying to like find this bottle and put it back on my bike. And
how many riders did you take out with that bottle?
Yeah, it was tactical. Took out a good chunk of the field. But I was just thinking, like, I can't believe this. I haven't even left the town yet and something's gone wrong. But, you know, that's it. I suppose those things will happen towards the start if you haven't really done enough testing of your setup.
It's almost like the bikes get nervous as well, though. You know, it's like the bikes have a little nervous moment and stuff goes wrong. Not just us.
Rob, that's the kind of thing that I'd expect you to say. Like, you know.
My bikes never get nervous.
You put them through some rigorous training, don't you, before they get to the start line. Psychological drilling.
I'm quite of the school of thought, you know, when people name their bikes and stuff, and I'm like, I won't name my bike, I won't give them a name or anything like that. I won't give them human characteristics. I'm very like, I'm the one who has the problems and the breakdowns, and the bike does what I ask it to.
The actual start itself is really dramatic, isn't it? Because it's at night, it's dark, you've got hundreds and hundreds of riders in the town square. And I don't know if they've done this every year, but my memory of it is the town mayor coming out in all this kind of like out big red outfit and, you know, white tassels, and he's ringing his bell and he's screaming and stuff and starting the race. And then you've got the lighting of the torches, all the crowd lights the torches and then goes up and lines the famous climb in the town, which is the Moor, which is this like really steep cobble climb. And to be part of that, almost like it's a ritual, isn't it? It's like a ceremony or something. It does feel quite special, doesn't it?
Yeah, it felt really, really powerful. I was not expecting, it feels like the whole of the town is out there kind of cheering and willing you on at 10 o'clock at night. I was not expecting that at all. And the year that I rode, and I guess Tom, the year that you rode as well, was the first year that the race was going ahead without Mike there to see us all off as well. So I think there was kind of an extra level of power and emotion in that start as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some powerful speeches and the town out there to cheer you on, and then off you go up the very ridiculous climb with all your silly bags on your bike, feeling nothing like the Tour of Flanders.
I'm glad you mentioned Mike, because of course we haven't mentioned him yet in the podcast, but of course he's there's no way you can talk about this without talking about him. And I mean, a lot of because I was lucky enough to meet him before the race and chat to Mike and Anna, and so, you know, told him like, you know, I'm gonna do this race, and he's like, okay. And it's funny because when you meet him, you can see he's sizing you up. He's like, has he got it in him, you know? Oh, that's what it feels like. He was very enigmatic, you know, you couldn't ever quite tell what he was thinking. But the race he created and that feeling at the start with the torches, were, you know, after the entire day of waiting, and then Mike gives his sort of like speech at the start, you know, I guess inspiring the riders in one way, but also warning them, and then sets you all off, and then you all race up, and yeah, the whole town is out with flaming torches as you ride up the Muir. But the feeling after is like when you actually, you crest the hill, and then you sort of like go into a stillness of night where there's no more cheering, there's no more torches, there's no more bright lights. All you get is the sound of the wind and the noise of, you know, chains going round and people pedaling and heavy breathing. And then you realize, oh, right, wow, it started. And it, you just go from this great big roar to this very stillness. And like, that's the start of your race.
And then the stillness increases when you're the one that turns off. You can see this light of blinking, stream of blinking rear lights in front of you, and then you kind of peel off, seemingly having plotted quite a different route from everyone else from fairly early on, and then you're plunged into even more silence and darkness. Yeah, very surreal feeling. That wasn't
plunged
that...
into a wheat field. I saw everyone else. Yeah, like I saw everyone else go that way, and I'm like, haha, I've outsmarted them. Obviously not. And I end up literally in the middle of a wheat field, and I guess it must have just been a route off Strava that was like during cyclocross season. Yeah, they go through this field, and I'm like, shit. Like, I think that was literally like 20 minutes into the race, I was already lost. So,
and you're thinking, oh my god, is the rest of my route going to be like this?
Yeah, it was.
It was just about testing the bike, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That, I mean, that's another thing about this race that, again, is quite unique, is like it's the only ultra I've done where you have to plot your route between checkpoints, or an ultra on this scale. I mean, the minefield of routing across countries, across Europe, across a continent, is so hard. Was, you know, luckily other ultras, you get a route and you follow the route and you don't have to worry about the planning. So half your time before this race, you've spent trying to work out your route and hoping it's okay, and then finding out quite quickly it's not. So.
Yeah, and the experience of planning your route versus the experience of actually being in the race, for someone that's doing that for the first time, you find out very, very quickly how different those experiences are. So there's this whole like psychological element of the fact that you've got freedom to create your own route that kicks in like almost straight away, doesn't it? As soon as you see the other red tail lights going a different route, you're like, oh wait, have I gone the wrong way? And you have to really like learn as you go along the race to sort of have that confidence in the route that you've spent so long planning.
Yeah, I think it's what makes this race so psychologically challenging compared to other races. There's so much room for doubt to creep in about your route, or just so much room to have planned a terrible route and to be quite right about doubting yourself. Yeah.
I thought we'd have a quick look at some of the social media that's been coming out before the race. A lot of people talking about their preparations, a lot of kit grids coming out. So the first one I thought we'd look at, Alan Parkinson here is talking about his sort of training and like conditioning himself, his body before the race. He says, since the start of this year, I've been attending body balance classes 3 times a week. This has made a significant difference in improving my core strength, which when the body gets tired from long hours in the saddle, things may go awry. And I thought this was interesting because it's not something that really people talk about. And it's actually, if you're talking about preparing for the race, there's so many different facets to that. Obviously, you've got to do a lot of riding and a lot of putting a lot of kilometers or hours on the bike. But people get a lot of injuries and a lot of people scratch due to almost like kind of muscle fatigue or just being in the same position for a long time, getting things like Schirmer's neck, and to see people preempting that and thinking about ways to, like, you know, add core strength is quite interesting, isn't it? So I don't know whether you guys had have done that for any of the races that you've done.
I'm not very good at getting to the gym, but I do know it's good for me. So I probably in my run in the run up to the TCR is doing bits and bobs of stuff in the gym. Did a little bit of cross training as well, so a bit of running, so that it's not always about being on the bike. And I feel like my body held up, at least my kind of muscle strength and fitness held up relatively well for me. It's maybe other stuff that went wrong. That said, I did get a bit of Schirmer's neck in the last couple of days. We can maybe talk about more about that another time. I think it was actually the setup of my bike had been slowly changing over the course of the race, and I was too tired and delirious to notice. And I think that was actually the reason. But yeah, I think, you know, core strength is always going to be a good thing, right? What about you guys? Did you do much?
Just the one that nobody wants to actually do, isn't it?
The least fun.
Yeah.
I have flipped my approach now, where core strength becomes kind of like the focus. But I mean, partly because a lot of the ultras that I take part in these days are like, have a lot of hiker bike. So you're going to spend a lot of time carrying your bike or pushing your bike as much as you are going to be riding it. But I sort of started to realize that once you have a level of fitness, you know, if you can ride 200K in a day, you can sort of ride an ultra, because you, well, there's a thing called empty miles, and I sort of subscribe to that idea where it's like, you know, countless hours riding beforehand doesn't necessarily add anymore. Because when you do this, you're not riding at threshold the entire way across Europe. You're going at quite a pace, and you know, even if you average, say, 20 kilometers per hour, and you ride 16 hours a day, you're still going to cover a huge distance in a day. But one of the things that I found really improved my ability to ride further was having the core strength. So I do a lot of stuff with like kettlebells and dumbbells in my in my flat at home. I just found that really helped. And when you get tired, when you have a bit more core strength, it doesn't become as uncomfortable and as painful. But I think also a lot of it comes down to experience as well, because I've also realized that it's not just about the fitness that will get you through. It's also about just having experienced it before. So now I know, like, there's certain pains that when they come, they're going to go. Was the first time I was doing this, I was trying to do all this stuff, change everything on my bike, make that go comfortable, do this, and I was wasting loads of time. Was now, whenever I ride and I get a pain in my shoulders or my back or whatever, I'm just like, yeah, I'm not going to feel that in an hour. And I don't know if it's like it stopped hurting or if it's your brain is just like, yeah, we're not listening to that anymore. That's sort of my approach anyway.
Nice. Next one is about packing and what to pack and what not to pack. And there's so many different approaches to this, but Nicholas Muxell, no idea how that's supposed to be pronounced. Sorry, Nicholas. But he says, riding without a real sleeping system, only a security blanket, X-frame mattress and a small silk layer. I prefer to stay in hotels while riding. So I guess by security blanket, he means one of those kind of like crinkly foil things, right? Like what you get at the end of a run, just an emergency sort of blanket. So he's really going all in on hotels, and the stuff that he has brought is kind of just a last resort if he has to sleep outside somewhere. So you know, this is kind of two different approaches, isn't it? Some people would go probably all in on hotels and maybe not take a backup at all at the extreme end. And then some people are taking full on sleeping kit, you know, bivy bag and a sleeping bag and a mat and everything. So what are the merits of those two approaches, and what are your guys' thoughts on that?
I mean, the emergency blankets are only good for emergency, because when you do sleep in them, they can't breathe. So they keep you warm, but they also make you really wet from from the moisture from your body, because it can't escape. But a lot of people, I think, do that so that it stops them from wanting to sleep. If you're really stuck, if you're in really bad weather or something happens and you can't get to the hotel, then you've got something that will stop you being too uncomfortable through the night. But it's also this method of I'm not gonna get out my sleep gear, because that's just gonna be awful, so I'm just gonna keep riding.
Yeah, the couple of ultra races I've done, I took a bit of a mix and match type approach. I don't ride with dynamo hubs, so I've always needed to have the odd hotel stop just to make sure I can recharge everything. But I was also pretty glad, to be honest, by the time I got to a recharge night, to just have a proper bed. And it is amazing what a difference that makes to you. Even if you're not getting loads more sleep, it does feel amazing to have had a night or half a night in a bed, and you ride better the next day. But I like the security of having a bivy and a sleeping bag. You can maybe be a bit less organized. You don't need to know where the hotels are. If you get caught out, you know you've got everything that you need with you. Probably some of the highlights from the race for me were to do with where I was bivvying, and their experiences that I'd have missed if I hadn't been bivvying and if I'd just been hoteling it the whole way. So I think, you know, there's probably, you could argue hotels or bivvying for speed, but you could also argue hotels or bivvying for the kind of enjoying the spirit of the race and the adventure and everything that comes your way, you know. Yeah, but in my heart, I'm a bivy and sleeping bag kind of a gal.
I have a weird relationship with bivying, because I love doing it, but also I find the whole, when you've been riding all day, it's nighttime, you're in an unfamiliar place, and then you're searching for somewhere to be a good bivy spot. And when I get tired and when I'm in the dark, I get like a really intense paranoia, I'm like, oh my God, what if someone finds me? What if this happens? You know, and that whole sleeping in a bus stop thing, I've done it, but I think it's the tiredness, because I'm so tired by that point, I find it really hard to settle on the spot that I feel safe in. So then the hotel thing, it depends where you are. Like when the races in Morocco, it's like you're in the middle of nowhere, it's like you're totally fine sleeping whatever it is you're sleeping. But in Europe, I always found it a bit more difficult, because I don't know, just something, the psychology of it really got to me, and I found it something hard to overcome. It's the same for nighttime riding has this big barrier to a lot of people, and I think it's the same. It's like once you enter the night, there's something that switches in your brain.
Yeah, just another couple of hurdles for these riders, and another interesting factor with them setting off at 10 o'clock, and you don't have to think about that so much for the first night, cause probably most people are going to just ride through. So it's only the second night that you're going to have to come across that sort of barrier, and then you'll find out how you react to it, I guess. Right, guys, I think it's probably a good time to wrap this one up. We've gone on a nice little journey there from like the preparation of the race through to turning up in Gerardsberg and how weird that first day is of registration and that sort of weird mix of like stress and also boredom, and then the excitement of the start. And then we've talked about riding off into the night, and we've started to talk about some of the challenges that comes with that. So I think that sets us up nicely for next time, when the riders will already be out on the road and will hopefully be bringing you the first roundup of how the actual race itself is shaping up. So I'll just say thanks to my expert panel once again. So thanks, Karen.
Cheers, Tom. I'm looking forward to seeing what chaos has already unraveled by the next time we meet.
Absolutely. And a massive thanks as well to Rob.
No problem, Tom. Good to be here.
Cheers, guys. Yeah, we'll see you next time. And don't forget, you can send in any questions about the TCR for Rob and Karen to chat about in the upcoming episodes. It can be anything you like. No subject is too silly or complex for these two. Send those in to race@transcontinental.cc with pod question as the subject, and you'll also be able to ask questions on the Transcontinental Instagram stories. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and a review, and we'll see you back here soon. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.